Two Pints in a Corner is a music history podcast about the Channel Club in Boston, Mass. Dinky Dawson and Tony Rain are your hosts. They interview Channel performers and workers, bringing out stories and memories of the great music and events that came through this iconic South Boston venue. Welcome to Two Pints in a Corner with Tony Rain and Dinky Dawson. Unfortunately, Tony is still out with illness that is getting better every day. So,
and a tip of my hat and a prayer to Tony if you talk to him.
And yes, this is Andrew Arsenal on the other end. And Peter Limbo, who's in the studio with us. And we're going to have a bit of fun today because we're going to be talking to the old production manager from the channel. And he's a lad and a half, let's put it that way. See, I knew I'd get that response. No, Andrew, what was the first show that you ever did and worked before you got employed there and stuff?
Well, at the time, I was working with Stephen Cataldo and the Nervous Eaters.
Ah, that was.
And we were touring around supporting the Elektra album. Rick Ocasek got the deal for them at Elektra. And so Mr. Cataldo, in his usual cranky way, after we had toured for a year or two, decided he was done with that whole lineup and he was going to disband the Nervous Eaters, as it was known at that time. Well, of course, in those days, when you were doing your farewell tour, it tended to go on for, you know, a year or two.
Minimum.
You kept doing it and doing it and doing it because you couldn't walk away from the money.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just going to say, it's called making money.
Right. But then the final show that it actually turned out to be the last show ever for that incarnation of the Eaters was at the Channel.
Oh, and, the last show.
And it was a very successful night. And I remember it like it was yesterday. I went into the office to settle up with Mr. Peter Boris.
Yeah.
And during the settlement, he said, well, what are you going to do now? Now that this thing is over. And I was like, I haven't thought that far ahead yet. And he said, we would like you to come on board here and work with us. What do you think about that? And I was like, tell me when you want to see me. And I showed up and they showed up and there we were for the a big chunk of the 1980s.
Yeah. Oh, so really you started early, early time then. Nervous Eaters, was that 81 or 82?
The Eaters album came out in like 80 or 81.
Yeah.
Of course, they had that, Elektra had that producer who had done one David Bowie album, but he could not translate the Eaters, to what they real from Rat Records to Elektra. Talk to Loretta was much edgier than what it was on the album, but it still kind of cut through. But the thing for me was, I knew the Eaters from the Rat days. I never knew what a prolific writer Stephen Cataldo was, and that he could write us a viable song in any genre of music, you know? And when I got with them, I was just kind of blown away.
Yeah, that's great stuff, because that happens when Peter had Charlie Farron. He was absolutely blown away what Charlie's done.
Yeah.
Writing and stuff, you know. And that's a good thing, because that really gets you interested in what's going on when you get writers and good stuff like that. And if they can perform the actual material, and Nervous Eaters did,
I think Peter will bear me out on this because I think we're close in age. I think we've been
into the same room many times.
Yeah, but also we've been aware of the music scene goings on for the same amount of time.
Yeah, we both started right about the same. I mean, I sort of found the Stompers in 78, and our first album was 83, I guess. You know, we did the local single stuff.
When the channel first opened, and Mark Giaquinto was the production guy.
Oh, my God.
For some reason, it took a while, I think the better part of a year, before I even set foot in that venue. I think because I was out being a production guy and working with Bruce Andor and, you know, this band and that band. And Warren, I met Warren at Salem State.
That's when I met him.
He was at the main act. And I was handling a band of guys from Revere. Peter, I'm sure you know the Sash.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Dana Vernon, and then, of course, Paul Caruso.
Yeah, good band.
Who left and went to the Atlantics. So it took me the better part of a year before I ever set foot in there. And the first time I ever stood side stage and watched an act, it was Sal.
Wow. Oh, no.
And it was Sal.
It's pretty good.
And the stage was so rickety, and I remember this clearly. Sal went off, finished his set, a smoking set, stormed off stage left at where the monitor rig was, and the stairs were a series of plastic milk crates that weren't even secured to each other.
Oh, no. And
he hit the top step. You must have been there, Peter.
I was at every Stomper show at the channel.
And he went down. He went right down.
Oh, no.
And, you know, he's not a young man you want to be around when he gets
I was just going to say, I'm sure that didn't make him very happy.
He was not happy. And it's too bad, too, because he smoked it, you know. And I was well aware of them, but that was the first time I had actually been able to stand there and concentrate on a show.
It's a lot of standing. It's probably the better part of 2.5 hours, I'm guessing.
You know, it was such an amazing thing for me. I think about a year and a half ago, I went to see the Stompers at Hampton Beach. Hmm. No, not Hampton Beach, Salisbury. And at the end of the night, he was sitting there signing autographs and what have you. And I was with Joanne Cody.
Wow.
And so we stopped, and I was just standing back, and he saw Joanne and, you know, big hugs and greetings and everything. And I wasn't saying anything. And then Joanne said, Sal, look, Andrew's here. And he was like, Andrew's from the channel, and he jumped up, he came over, and gave me a big hug, and all
that. I love it. That's like a great recognition. You did them well, kiddo.
You know, but what I was started to say with Peter, I mean, for all the different scenes, music scenes we've seen in Boston throughout our careers, that the 80s with, you know, that music scene with the channel and all the bands who reached acclaim with their original stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, and then, you know, like the punk bands and everybody.
Everybody up to, including people like Roy Orbison, yeah. You know? I mean.
Oh, my God. He did his last. Second to the last show there.
Yes, he did. And I was there.
And I was there. You know what? I was there with Glenn Danzig.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You were out with them.
I was on tour with Danzig.
Yeah, that's right.
And we happened to be in Boston that weekend.
Wow.
And I don't know if you guys know this, but Glenn Danzig and Roy Orbison wrote the soundtrack for the Less Than Zero movie.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Pretty amazing.
And here's the weird thing. Rick, who's the big producer? His last name is escaping me.
I'm not sure. There's so many Rick.
Anyway, he was producing the soundtrack. Roy Orbison got a writer's block, and Rick was managing. He had Deaf American Records, which Glenn Danzig was one of the big Lawyers. Acts.
Yeah.
And
my lawyer was his lawyer, Paul Schindler.
and then Rick and Rick Shore had a management company. And they not only were was Danzig's record label, they were the management company as well.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I don't know if that was legal, but that's how it was.
Paul Schindler being my attorney, when we signed with Boardwalk Records, he was their attorney. And then when I signed on Richie Cordell to produce the record, he was Richie Cordell's lawyer. So we had a three-way partnership, and we all had to sign, you know, non-competition, whatever it was, so we could keep everything nice and neat.
But those were the days you could do all that. Today you couldn't do a diddly squat.
Not in a heartbeat.
Because it's all been exposed, all those backroom deals.
But it's not just the backroom deals, Andrew. It's the situation where, we don't want you to play with another artist from a record company. We don't want you to, we want the same people on the same tour from the record companies and this, that, and the other. And it's like, you know, it's just too much. It's not like it was. You're having a fun with the Nervous Eaters. They had fun with different musicians too, like Rick Berlin people, you know, and they would also play with them. Well, it was the same for me with Fleetwood and with the Birds, with this, that, and the other. We'd all play different things, you know, and have different musicians and friends around that we met on tour. But today you just can't do it. Just going back to your Nervous Eaters. I think it was June 13th, 1981 was the last show you did, because in 81 you did every month of June, except that was the last one.
And stuff. Wow.
And I'm saying, that was interesting. You know, but
that feels exactly right of when that all went down.
So you were talking of that time period, which is time period. I have no idea. I was about with mamas and papas then, so I have no idea what's what. Except I used to come there to the channel when it first opened to see a South Shore band that I was running around with, because I just used to enjoy the company of them people. And that.
Who is that?
State of Mind. Robbie.
And I remember that.
He's a good guitarist, good drummers, and good musicians.
That was a great thing about the channel. If you weren't working on a certain night, you could go to the channel and see either your friends on the stage or in the audience.
Exactly.
I mean, it wasn't just going to see a concert. It was going to hang out with your friends. I think I did more business in the channel than I ever did in my office on Lincoln Street with Tim Collins.
I believe you
would go there, and everybody you wanted to see was there, and so you made all your deals and talked about what you were going to do. It was just a great place to meet and hang.
So what was the best nights you went?
A great Petri dish.
That's a great way of doing it.
Yeah, that's like a great phrase. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, because it was a scene. I mean, there were so many different genres of music every day that it was amazing. You get reggae one night, or in a day you would get Spinal Tap. Oh, come on, I got to hear that Spinal Tap.
You know what? You didn't have, if he hears me, I hope he doesn't hold it against me, but you didn't have the Don Law pomposity. You know, you didn't have the Lansdowne Street pomposity. It was just fun.
It was fun. It was the only place in town that was really fun.
Really fun.
You know, I mean, you still got the rat that was fun up to a point because, but it was, I mean, I can't even believe
it. Except if you had to go to the bathroom.
Yeah, oh, yeah, that's the difference.
Or if you had an aversion to rats.
No. Oh, yeah.
But you know what you were just saying about Don Law? I mean, name me another, besides Frank Russo in Providence, but name me another concert organization and another booking agent like Mr. Warren Scott who succeeded in getting new important music, you know, to put on your stage.
Oh, you know what?
Don Law,
Don and I got along great. He called me one day, asked me if there was anybody in my office, and I was like, no, of course there were, but I didn't tell him that. I just told everybody to shut up. And at that point, he said, I'm going to have the Stompers open for the Rolling Stones. I'm like, what? If word gets out, it's a surprise Stone show. It can't happen. So it turned out some clown from WBZ TV crashed through a door at City Hall at the City Hall meeting, and he blew the story up over the air, and they canceled the show. Yeah. And then
The show didn't even happen.
It went out to Worcester to Sir Morgan's Cove just to get out of Boston.
Right.
So Andrew, we got a question. I was talking to Warren the other day. We're going to talk again now in a few weeks here on a Wednesday. He was talking about his Divine show. Do you remember?
Oh my God!
Do you remember the date of that or the year or whatever?
Yeah, I don't remember the dates, but I'll tell you what. Like Spinal Tap, and like the Divine show. You know, he pulled some stuff.
Oh, that's what he's going to tell us. He's going to tell us how we got the both of them. But he can't remember.
The Spinal Tap, they weren't even thinking about doing live dates.
No, he's going to tell us.
That was his total idea, and he went to the movie production company and put it all together.
He's going to tell us all that stuff because that's a good story. But I wanted to hear from you. You worked that as a production manager, and I heard the roof fell on him.
So, but the Divine thing, I got to tell you, he was getting ready his show, and I walked in the dressing room. And he was sitting there putting his makeup on and everything, but his bosom was laying on the counter next to him.
There you go.
But that was, people didn't even know, you know, what that was all about. If you hadn't seen the movie and survived the shock of the movie and what that was all about, especially the final scene. And, of course, that was one of the big winners for shows at the channel, you know, for avant-garde type stuff that we ended up doing all the time. But the
Do you remember the year?
Spinal Tap, huh?
Do you remember the year of Divine?
No, that, you know, for me, that was the 1980 to... whenever.
Yeah,
that
okay.
Our mind blanking time.
I'm with you. That's what Warren said.
It was a decade equaled 1 year in those days.
Yeah, because you worked 7 days a week. No.
But the Spinal Tap thing, if you remember, we did two shows. It was the World Tour, and the World Tour consisted of the two shows at the channel, and I think two shows in San Francisco. And that was it. So it was an all-ages show and, you know, a regular show at night. So I was I had to go pick Christopher Guest up at the airport. And he's the guy who was the Jeff Beck-looking character, Nigel Tufnell, the guy whose amplifiers went to 11.
And yeah.
So I had to go pick him up. And he comes out, and I wasn't thinking that he was the straight comedian guy. I was looking for a Jeff Beck kind of guy. He comes up.
Wrong.
He comes out and he's carrying a round hat box. And that was his wig was in there. And for some reason, and it was a torrential downpour.
Yeah. Yep.
That day. And what was it like being on the stage of the channel on any time there
drip,
was
drip,
a torrential
drip,
downpour?
Drip,
drip, drip,
drip. No, this was more than drip, drip, drip. This was get Costas up on the roof.
Yeah, right.
with tar and whatever. But anyway, so he, all the way to the channel, he's pissing and moaning about this and that. I don't know. I think he wasn't really a big fan of the live date or whatever. And the money for them to get there for the money they paid them was even more amazing, because it was, you would have thought it would have been a lot more money. But anyway, we walk into the channel, and he's standing beside me, and the first thing that we walk in, and I knew where to look. I looked immediately at the stage. And he must have followed my gaze, because he looked and he was like, if I get electrocuted tonight. and he said, I ain't going on that stage. What are you, crazy? It was pouring. It was like a monsoon, right? And the biggest amount of water was coming through the roof right where he would be standing.
Oh, jeez.
So needless to say, we had our hands full to get ready for the All Ages show, but that really drove him the rest of the way off the edge. But, you know, it was one of those iconic shows that we did there.
It was 7th of July, 1984, and Lizzie Borden and the Axis played, and the Bumsteads and Midnight.
Lizzie Borden played?
According to my notes from the data.
Wow.
The database.
Wow.
And Spinal Tap, and then that thing fell down on top of them, and the crowd thought it was actually part of the show. That's what I heard.
But, are you saying that to your recollection, the roof actually collapsed a little bit?
Well, the panel, you know, them panels and white panels got absolutely soaked, and it just dropped out. Whether you did it, you know, prior to the show or whatever, but they said that was like. This is a couple of people that went was saying that because I wasn't there. I mean, I didn't come in there till 1986 properly. You know, I didn't that when we were all changing everything. You know, and but I was on about this show because I just thought it was hilarious that the roof had fallen at the same time and playing the I've got the T-shirt on that goes to 11 right now and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I put it on just because I knew you would say something about the 11, because all engineers and people like you, you do.
And you know what's funny? After you see the movie, and if you're actually a touring person, there's a lot of scenes in that movie that if you've been on tour...
We've all been through. Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Totally. I mean, you know.
How many times have you been lost in the bowels of an old theater trying to get from your dressing room to the stage?
I got,
and probably held the show up 20 minutes
at least
because you were lost.
The Carnegie Hall's one of them. I got lost in the organ upstairs. I couldn't get out of there. I didn't know where to go. I got Hampton Hawes did on a show, and I was like, oh my goodness, this is just beautiful jazz. Why am I stuck up in the organ? Because they wanted me to go check it out. Yeah, right. They wanted me to get me out of there so the union guy could turn up the sound, you know, that kind of thing. But there's always tricks with this lot.
I mean, think about this. One of the regulars who stood at, you know, that corner of the bar where I always stood, and he was standing right next to me for 2 years or 3 years straight, was Mr. Jimmy Miller.
Oh, yeah.
The
guy who produced
8 of the Rolling Stones'
best
albums.
Yeah.
And he was a regular there.
Yeah, for those years, he definitely was. That's right.
And then anybody who came into town to see him, they were there hanging out, whether it be, you know, Marianne Faithfull
or this one or that one. Yeah, they all hung out. Some of them, when Charlie came through, though, he didn't want to. He said, is Jimmy Miller here? Well, I don't want to see Jimmy Miller. You know, that kind of thing. And
Charlie Watts?
Oh, yeah, when Charlie played.
Yeah.
That was awesome.
I mean, it was one of my, it was always a goal of mine when I started there to make sure that it was a real rock and roll musician's place to go and do a show. And, not something where that wasn't the idea.
Well, in my life, being a personal manager, my going there was trying to see these young bands on a big stage with great production.
Yeah.
You know, you go to a club and, you had a great time. You don't remember if it was what it was that made you enjoy it. But when you see them on a concert stage with good concert production, you really understand the potential of a band.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah, that's the beauty of that stage.
What about Amy Mann at an all-age Sunday afternoon show? The first time I saw her.
You had a good time with that one because she can sing when she wants to.
I mean, it like I called it a Petri dish earlier, it was a real down and dirty, you know, concert venue. And everybody involved there, you, Dinky, Peter, guys like you, you know, it was all a spice to the pieces of pie that made that place the way it was, made it where, you know, Greg Allman, anytime he was coming in, he was always there a night or two early just to hang out.
Yeah, March 2nd, 84, Midnight Traveler, Greg Allman, David Leonard's group, that kind of stuff. You're right about that. There were so many people that used to come in there prior to the show or after the show or if they played Boston Garden. I mean, I had Christine. Yep. Christine came over and we were checking with her with the, you know, from Fleetwood Mac days and stuff, and even John Boy took a photograph of me and Christina when I took him to the garden and stuff and to meet Fleetwood and what have you. And John Boy was always running around. You and John Boy were the two that were key on the whole place to me, you know, in a lot of stuff. You on production, you doing all the necessities, and enjoying yourself at the same time, you know, because when you had the shows open time wise, you were there on the side of the stage whipping them off if they were on the wrong, you know, especially the five bands a night business and stuff like that. You would whip them off on the right time and they'd gone. And we were out the back door, poof, and next one was up. It was great.
It was an art form.
And look at how many genres of music
were
born at that time period.
That's why Warren did so well, because Don Law's people would only book certain genres of music, a complete other side of the music, from reggae to to the world music completely was not really booked by Don. He never really wanted that up there.
Well, he never understood.
He never understood it for true. And
I mentioned the story when we were talking to somebody else doing one of these podcasts that a good friend of mine worked in the office at Don's office in Cambridge. And one day, Don's in his office with the door closed, and he starts screaming. Don, it wasn't a happy guy. He starts screaming. He's got a contract in his hand. He opens the door, and he yells into everybody in the office, "Who the hell is this band Sade, and why am I paying them all this money?" It was Sade. He had no idea.
Wow.
That's why Dave Martin took off. No, the one sat in the corner from here, Nancy, was the first booking agent for Don Law and stuff.
So, you know, you say what you will. You know, if you were up against him, you know, good luck to you. How we were so successful at it. It was a God thing, or was it?
It was personnel. It was the personnel, like Warren, and going to New York, seeing certain people in New York, and walking into their offices and giving them the time of day.
There were certain agents who didn't like Don Law,
and a lot,
but
right.
B,
yes, of course,
but B, they had to overpay. That's really how they got a lot of this talent, was having to overpay.
Right. And Warren had cut his teeth at the main act.
Oh, yeah,
so
yeah, yeah.
He got his relationship started outside of Boston.
Well, he got him started when he was in college. I mean, he was booking Salem State.
Yep, that's when I met him. But then the main act, you know, was his first foray into, you know, look who we had there. The Ramones, you know.
He books some great people along the way. There's no doubt about it.
Roy Orbison at the main act.
Yeah, he did.
He did.
Oh, I missed that.
And
one.
There weren't that many people there. I don't think anybody really believed it, but I actually have a photograph of my brother and myself standing on either side of Roy Orbison. It's up on the wall in my home, autographed, and. It was unbelievable. I mean,
yeah, the night the night there at the Channel was phenomenal when he were on that stage. You're right, it became a concert, but it became an intimate concert because there was 3,000 or whatever people there, and it was just everyone was just, oh my God, you know, that kind of thing, because it was so good, so well done. All the artists that perform on there. You know, there was one artist here that were a bit dicky here and a bit dicky there, as we all went through. But the attitudes changed as soon as they hit the stage and started getting feedback from all the crowd and whatever.
God, it was, you know,
unbelievable.
You couldn't beat that.
No.
You were in the middle of the audience. And if you were succeeding at your thing, You know, it was probably rare that you got that kind of immediate feedback.
It was funny. We shot the Stompers video at the Channel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what we did was corral, you know, maybe 20 feet in front of the stage. And we were going to find some real fans that we knew we could count on, you know, for those
shots,
up-close shots. And I'm telling you, everybody wanted to be in the corral. It was like insanity. I mean, once we got the place half full, then it was the end of it. Everything came down, and everybody just rushed the stage.
I got a good question on a different thing. Were you there and helping when Spencer for Hire was in there?
Yes, I was. I was there every day for that.
So, do you have a good time with the Spencer people?
You know, it was pretty, it was interesting. It was kind of thrilling that, you know, of every place they could have gone and done that episode, they did it there, you know, a tribute to they wanted to have a real down and dirty club location to pull off the story. And, you know, it was just great to be there and be a part of it. And it was something out of left field.
Good.
That you never thought would have happened.
It's a great experience, you know? That kind of stuff. But I thought from you, you'd say about Spencer, because it was definitely good, well produced.
It was a great show. I love that show on TV.
And so, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go on. Continue.
So one of the genres that was really breaking out like wildfire, you know, the punk thing had started in England, but in the Channel days, the American punk thing was really, you know, really heating up, the LA punk bands.
Oh, yeah.
There was all the West Coast. Well, so the Bouncers, you know, the stage diving thing.
Oh, yeah, I was about to be. Oh, my God.
It was a big contention. Oh. And it was a big contention for me because the club policy didn't want it.
Yeah.
But then it was, you know, I was mindful that that was part of the scene.
Yeah.
And the bands, you know, that made the show all the better.
So thank God the insurance agents weren't there, though.
Oh, my God. So I came to a point with security and everything where I would have the security guys around the stage, but we would let the stage diving go for a little bit before we sent in the troops and cleared the stage.
Yeah.
So one night was Black Flag. I'll never forget it.
Oh, my God.
The stage diving was insane. The mosh pit in front of the stage was just kinetic anger.
Anger, yeah.
And so finally I unleashed the hounds.
Oh, good.
to clear off the stage. And for whatever reason, I must have been so caught up, I found myself on stage throwing punk rockers off the stage.
Done that.
So here's the scene. I've got my back to the audience. I've got a punk in my left hand, a punk in my right hand, and I'm swinging my arms to throw them off the stage behind me. And as I'm doing that, I look upstage, and there's a kid coming at me from the drum riser.
Oh, no.
He body blocks me with the two kids that I got already right off the downstage edge. And now I'm on the floor in the mosh pit.
Oh, no, no, no.
And I'm like, wow, this is how my life's going to end. I'm gonna be trampled to death in a mosh pit. And I swear to God, when I got up off that floor, I had U.S. Army boot prints on my face.
Oh, no.
I had to fight my way up off the floor. I think security finally realized where I was, and they, you know, waded into the crowd to get me out of there. It was crazy.
That sounds really crazy. Sean McNally was talking about all this stuff with it, because he brought in a lot of the bands with Cringe. Later on, you know, they still do the mosh stuff even now, you know, what have you. But it's more controlled now. They do it. They've figured it out how to really get off on it and then not hurt anybody except themselves and stuff, you know.
I mean, the mosh pits were outrageous in those days.
Oh, they were. I did Butthole Surfers, and I think I talked about this on a previous podcast, and Gibby set fire to the damn cymbal with lighter fluid, hit the cymbal with a stick and lighter fluids all over the stage. I whipped his ass right out that back door with his amplifier and him in the guitar.
Oh, right, right. I remember you saying that. Yeah.
It's just that kind of stuff is shit, because 3 weeks later or 2 weeks later, the thing happened down in Rhode Island. We'd already taken all Spinal Tap, as I call it, roof down, and Costa went up there and, you know, painted more tar on there and covered the whole roof, and it stopped it all leaking. But the false roof is because the punkers were hanging out on the top of the frames up there, swinging around.
Yeah.
I'm sure you had the same thing when they possibly could to swing up there and do the mosh pit thing, you know. So,
well, they would come in the afternoon.
Yeah.
Before sound check.
Yeah.
And they'd hide up in the drop ceiling.
That's exactly it's insane stuff, you know.
And Walter, the drummer for what's that punk band with Chris? He was a drummer for the Eaters for a while.
Oh, with Chris
Gustafson, Walter Gustafson. He stole the one night the sink in the holding room that we would put ice and beer in.
Yeah,
I walked in before their show to make sure, you know, they had some beer and stuff, and that sink was gone.
No.
And Walter, because they had drank all the beer, and Walter was pissed off, he hid the sink above the drop ceiling.
That's hilarious.
And they were standing there saying, "Whoa, we don't know where it went. Whoa, what happened to the sink?"
That's hilarious. I like that one. That is hilarious. Absolutely.
So I just remembered this the other day, getting back to the Eaters real quick. We were in, touring, supporting the Elektra album, and we were in upstate New York, and we had a club date, and there was two bands on the bill. It was the Nervous Eaters, and believe it or not, before her first album came out, Cyndi Lauper's band.
Wow.
Oh, Blue Angel.
But the problem was the band, there was advertised for three sets.
Oh.
So now it's the afternoon at soundcheck, and of course,
three sets.
You know, signed, both bands are signed. Who's going to do both, you know, two sets instead of one? And nobody wanted it, you know, was going to do it. And I say, well, let's do this. Let's put both bands together and do an opening set of, you know, classic covers.
Yeah.
And that's what happened. Cyndi Lauper and Steve did the opening set together.
Wow.
That's the kind of stuff I like. That kind of stuff is great.
You know? And then, of course, you know, a couple months later, you know, Girls Just Want to Have Fun is blowing up the airwaves.
Well, you had the drummer there was John Morelli, and John was here in Plymouth. He's been here for a long time, and he used to run all the British British BBCs, which is a pubs down here. And he's brought up here in Plymouth and stuff, and he's a good lad. And he's still around. And Cyndi, actually, I think, goes on the Cape near where Peter lives, is in Hyannis area. She goes on for the summer and stuff. But
she's doing her final tour right now.
This is it. This is the final tour. But she could sing in still five octaves, you know. That girl could
I mean,
it blew me away. And had fun, like you said, with other people. That was the thing. And it's tough. So she's doing the last tour. It's good to see some of the people that you think, I tried to get my old friend Spanky McFarlane from Spanky and I gang out, but she can sing still, but at 82 or 83, she's just legs and stuff in the back and everything. And we used to have a paramedic on the road 10 years ago with us, just so she would be all right. And looking after her, and we had hospital oxygen at every gig and stuff like that.
Before we called you, thinking I were talking about Judy Collins, and I was saying that she can't even play guitar anymore because of arthritis, and she's got a small band with her now, and she just stands up and sings. But
because Nancy, what she said early on, she had that all those years of actual vocal training, which I know a lot more about than people understand.
Because obviously, why she's lasted so long, she can still sing. I saw her last year; she can still sing like a bird.
You get it to a certain age, and that kind of stuff isn't and stuff. But anyway, are you still doing productions and stuff like that here and there?
So here and there, I'm still doing entertainment, but I got, I found this niche while I was married and raising a family, and I got into the corporate side.
Production. Good one.
Yeah, then doing checks
I was just going to say corporate meetings and
their checks clear.
Yeah. Well, you know what? And my son Drew is like one of the quickly becoming one of the live video engineers in the corporate world.
Oh, cool!
And he was just in Mexico City for a CEO, the C-suite of Coca-Cola for their. It was a big secret meeting in Mexico City 2 weeks ago, and he was the disguise operator. Disguise is a video server system, and my son is a maniac. When he takes on a project, he finds out things that a product can do that even the creators of the product didn't realize.
That's
that
cool.
Their product could do that. So.
It's like Dad.
Chip off the old block.
Chip off the old one, you know?
Well, yeah. And, you know, it's funny. Yeah. His mother used to say to me, he'll never go. I don't ever want you telling him to go into that business. Because, you know, I'd leave for work on the morning of March 1st and get home April 27th, you know. That's how intense your schedule gets for that.
Wow. You're
on the corporate side of things. It's like, you know, it's heavy as touring, but you don't go anywhere.
Yeah, that's...
You know, you live in the suburbs of Boston, and then you're at every convention venue in Boston that has a big event going on.
I like this. That's the way to do it. I have a lot of roadies that were out with me. Chris Adamson, who's been out with the big boys, that's all he's doing right now is just big corporate gigs and stuff like that. His days are running around the world as sort of numbered, even though he was out with Metallica last year and stuff like that. Because he had the English guys from Sheffield. And with the drummer with the one arm, I forget his name now. But anyway, the bottom line
I'm actually blessed that the crew of people that I have were the favorites at Fenway Park. And they do a lot, you wouldn't think about this, but they do a lot of corporate meetings and events at Fenway Park.
Oh, is that, McLaughlin?
No.
Oh, he does.
No,
that's different.
It's a company out of North Carolina called Heard Global Productions. They're the in-house production company, and the people that they hire to run that operation are Boston AV guys that I've known for decades, and so they come to me for specific audio engineers and video engineers and all that.
Perfect. Now you got that sorted. That's good.
Yeah.
Anyway, kiddo, we're going to have to call it today, but there's a possibility that we may have you again when Warren's here, when he's talking, and that's going to be April 15th. We're going to have a chat with Warren. And Peter can't wait for that one either.
So, I just hope he leaves some of the stories out. That's all.
No, we don't need all that. We need the ones that, these stories that Andrew just told are fantastic.
Yeah, they're great.
Good, man. I mean, that's your life, and it's good life and stuff too. So,
I got the only channel swag I have is a little black button that lives on this great leather jacket that I got in London. and it's just black and white. It says the channel.
Yeah,
it's,
I got one.
It's just a little bit bigger than a quarter.
Yeah, I got one.
And, I got one too.
Yep, and you'd be amazed that, you know, you walk into the men's room and all of a sudden there's people. Oh, the channel, it's the best place.
Well, you know, with me,
my life and everything.
Yeah, it's, like, see, it's here really interesting because I've got a jacket that I've got the channel on there and embroidery and stuff. And you know, because I own the trademark, I decided to spend a lot of money on this, that, and the other. So I'm walking around, and every time we go like the BJ's or somewhere, you know, all of a sudden, oh, I went there, that was fantastic. Can I tell you? So my oncology doctor brings me over to another oncology doctor in Plymouth here. He was a drummer for the number one group out of Rhode Island that played the channel.
No kidding.
I started
there
laughing.
There you go.
Started laughing. Anyway, I got to call it off of this one now. And it's
all
been...
right, boys. It was great to talk to you.
Same here, Andrew.
Cruise down memory lane with you two.
You sound great.
And, yeah, anytime you want to talk, let me know.
Yeah, we'll chat when Warren's here. Because
that'll be great.
That'll be two of you guys having some fun, you know.
So, I'll be around.
Okay, definitely. Two Pints in the Corner checking out this week with Andrew Arsenal and Peter Limbo. And thank you to all involved, Chris in the engineering department, and let's have a good one. Signing out.
God bless.
There we go. God bless. Thank you, Andrew.
See you, Andrew.
Thank you.
Take care, Peter.
See you, brother.
Yeah. Bye-bye.